I were beginning at last to acquire some vague notion of what it meant. It is the struggle between one individual and another, a then and there struggle, in which the immediate triumph is everything. Human beings never submit to human beings. Even slaves practice their mean retaliations. Human beings cannot conceive of any means of survival except in terms of a single then and there contest. They speak of duty to one's country and such like things, but the object of their efforts is invariably the individual, and, even once the individual's needs have been met, again the individual comes in. The incomprehensibility of society is the incomprehensibility of the individual. The ocean is not society. It is individuals. This was how I managed to gain a modicum of freedom from my terror at the illusion of the ocean, called the world. I learned to behave rather aggressively, without the endless anxious worrying I knew before, responding, as it were, to the needs of the moment. When I left the apartment in Koenji, I told the madam of the bar in Kyobashi, "I've left her and come to you." That was all I said, and it was enough. In other words, my single then-and-there contest had been decided, and from that night, I lodged myself without ceremony on the second floor of her place. Society, which by all rights should have been implacable, inflicted not a particle of harm on me, and I offered no explanations. As long as the madam was so inclined, everything was all right. At the bar, I was treated like a customer, like the owner, like an errand boy, like a relative of the management. One might have expected that I would be considered a very dubious character, but society was not in the least suspicious of me, and the regular customers of the bar treated me with almost painful kindness. They called me by my first name and bought me drinks. I gradually came to relax my vigilance towards the world. I came to think that it was not such a dreadful place. My feelings of panic had been molded by the unholy fear aroused in me by such superstitions of science as the hundreds of thousands of whooping cough germs borne by the spring breezes, the hundreds of thousands of eye-destroying bacteria which infest the public baths, the hundreds of thousands of microbes in a barber shop which will cause baldness, the swarms of scabious parasites infecting the leather straps in the subway cars, or the tapeworm, fluke, and heaven knows what eggs that undoubtedly lurk in raw fish and in undercooked beef and pork, or the fact that if you walk barefoot, a tiny sliver of glass may penetrate the sole of your foot and, after circulating through your body, reach the eye and cause blindness. There is no disputing the accurate scientific fact that millions of germs are floating, swimming, wriggling everywhere. At the same time, however, if you ignore them completely, they lose all possible connection with yourself, and at once become nothing more than vanishing ghosts of science. This, too, I came to understand. I had been so terrorized by scientific statistics. If 10 million people each leave over 3 grains of rice from their lunch, how many sacks of rice are wasted in one day? If 10 million people each economize 1 paper handkerchief a day, how much pulp will be saved? That whenever I left over a single grain of rice, whenever I blew my nose, I imagined that I was wasting mountains of rice, tons of paper, and I fell prey to a mood dark as if I had committed some terrible crime. But these were the lies of science, the lies of statistics and mathematics. You can't collect 3 grains of rice from everybody. Even as an exercise in multiplication or division, it ranks as one of the most elementary and feeble-minded problems, about on a par with the computation of the percentage of times that people slip in dark, unlighted bathrooms and fall into the toilet, or the percentage of passengers who get their feet caught in the space between the door of a subway train and the edge of the platform, or other such footling exercises in probability. These events seem entirely within the bounds of possibility, but I have never heard a single instance of anyone hurting himself by falling into the toilet. I felt pity and contempt for the self which until yesterday had accepted such hypothetical situations as eminently factual scientific truths and was terrified by them. This shows the degree to which I had bit by bit arrived at a knowledge of the real nature of what is called the world. Having said that, I must now admit that I was still afraid of human beings, and before I could meet even the customers in the bar, I had to fortify myself by gulping down a glass of liquor. The desire to see frightening things, that was what drew me every night to the bar where, like the child who squeezes his pet all the harder when he actually fears it a little, I proclaimed to the customer standing at the bar my drunken, bungling theories of art. A comic strip artist, and at that an unknown one, knowing no great joys nor, for that matter, any great sorrows. I craved desperately some great savage joy, no matter how immense the suffering that might ensue. But my only actual pleasure was to engage in meaningless chatter with the customers and to drink their liquor. Close to a year had gone by since I took up this debased life in the bar in Kyobashi. My cartoons were no longer confined to the children's magazines, but now appeared also in the cheap pornographic magazines that are sold in railway stations. Under a silly pseudonym, I drew dirty pictures of naked women, to which I usually appended appropriate verses from the Rubaiyat. Waste not your hour, nor in the vain pursuit of this and that endeavor and dispute. Better be merry with the fruitful grape than sadden after none or bitter fruit. Some for the glories of this world, and some sigh for the prophet's paradise to come. Ah, take the cash, and let the promise go, nor heed the music of a distant drum. And that inverted bowl we call the sky, where under crawling cooped we live and die. Lift not your hands to it for help, for it, as impotently, rolls as you or I. There was at this period in my life a maiden who pleaded with me to give up drink. You can't go on, drinking every day from morning to night that way. She was a girl of 17 or so, who worked in a little tobacco shop across the way from the bar. Yoshiko, that was her name, was a pale girl with crooked teeth. Whenever I went to buy cigarettes, she would smile and repeat her advice. What's wrong with drinking? Why is it bad? Better be merry with the fruitful grape than sadden after none or bitter fruit. Many years ago there was a Persian. No, let's skip it. Oh, plague no more with human or divine. Tomorrow's tango to itself resign, and lose your fingers in the tresses of the cypress slender minister of wine. Do you understand? No, I don't. What a stupid little girl you are. I'm going to kiss you. Go ahead. She pouted out her lower lip, not in the least abashed. You silly fool. You and your ideas of chastity. There was something unmistakable in Yoshiko's expression, which marked her as a virgin who had never been defiled. Soon after New Year, one night in the dead of winter, I drunkenly staggered out in the cold to buy some cigarettes and fell into a manhole in front of her shop. I shouted for Yoshiko to come save me. She hauled me out and bandaged my bruised right arm. Yoshiko, earnest and unsmiling, said, "You drink too much." The thought of dying has never bothered me, but getting hurt, losing blood, becoming crippled and the like, no thanks. I thought as I watched Yoshiko bandage my hand that I might cut down on my drinking. I'm giving it up. From tomorrow on, I won't touch a drop. Do you mean it? There's no doubt about it. I'll give it up. If I give it up, will you marry me, Yoshiko? Asking her to marry me was, however, intended only as a joke. Natch? Natch, for naturally was popular at the time. Right. Let's hook fingers on that. I promise I'll give it up. The next day, as might have been expected, I spent drinking. Towards evening, I made my way to Yoshiko's shop on shaking legs and called to her.
Yoshiko, I'm sorry, I got drunk.
Oh, you're awful. Trying to fool me by pretending to be drunk.
I was startled. I felt suddenly quite sober.
No, it's the truth. I really have been drinking. I'm not pretending.
Don't tease me. You're mean.
She suspected nothing.
I should think you could tell just by looking at me. I've been drinking today since noon. Forgive me.
You're a good actor.
I'm not acting, you little idiot. I'm going to kiss you.
Go ahead.
No, I'm not qualified. I'm afraid I'll have to give up the idea of marrying you. Look at my face. Red, isn't it? I've been drinking.
It's just the sunset shining on it. Don't try to fool me. You promised yesterday you wouldn't drink. You wouldn't break a promise, would you? We hooked fingers. Don't tell me you've been drinking. It's a lie. I know it is.
Yoshiko's pale face was smiling as she sat there inside the dimly lit shop. What a holy thing uncorrupted virginity is, I thought. I had never slept with a virgin, a girl younger than myself. I'd marry her. I wanted once in my lifetime to know that great savage joy, no matter how immense the suffering that might ensue. I had always imagined that the beauty of virginity was nothing more than the sweet, sentimental illusion of stupid poets. But it really is alive and present in this world. We would get married. In the spring, we'd go together on bicycles to see waterfalls framed in green leaves. I made up my mind on the spot. It was a then and there decision, and I did not hesitate to steal the flower. Not long afterwards, we were married. The joy I obtained as a result of this action was not necessarily great or savage, but the suffering which ensued was staggering, so far surpassing what I had imagined that even describing it as horrendous would not quite cover it. The world, after all, was still a place of bottomless horror. It was by no means a place of childlike simplicity, where everything could be settled by a single then-and-there decision. The Third Notebook, Part 2. Horiki and myself. Despising each other as we did, we were constantly together, thereby degrading ourselves. If that is what the world calls friendship, the relations between Horiki and myself were undoubtedly those of friendship. I threw myself on the chivalry of the madam of the bar in Kyobashi. It is a strange use of the word to speak of a woman's chivalry, but in my experience, at least in the cities, the women possessed a greater abundance of what might be termed chivalry than the men. Most men concerned themselves, all fear and trembling, only with appearances, and were stingy to boot. She enabled me to marry Yoshiko and to rent a room on the ground floor of an apartment building near the Sumida River, which we made our home. I gave up drink and devoted my energies to drawing cartoons. After dinner, we would go out together to see a movie, and on the way back we would stop at a milk bar or buy pots of flowers. But more than any of these things, it gave me pleasure just to listen to the words or watch the movements of my little bride, who trusted in me with all her heart. Then, just when I had begun to entertain faintly in my breast the sweet notion that perhaps there was a chance I might turn one of these days into a human being and be spared the necessity of a horrible death,
Hariki showed up again. He hailed me.
How's the great lover?
Why, what's this? Do I detect a note of caution in your face?
You of all people?
I've come today as a messenger from the Lady of Koenji.
He lowered his voice and thrust his jaw in the direction of Yoshiko, who was preparing tea in the kitchen, as much as to ask whether it was all right to continue. I answered nonchalantly. It doesn't matter. You can say anything before her. As a matter of fact, Yoshiko was what I should like to call a genius at trusting people. She suspected nothing of my relations with the madam of the bar in Kyobashi, and even after I told her all about the incident which occurred at Kamakura, she was equally unsuspicious of my relations with Tsuneko. It was not because I was an accomplished liar. At times I spoke quite bluntly, but Yoshiko seemed to take everything I said as a joke.
You seem to be just as cocksure of yourself as ever. Anyway, it's nothing important. She asked me to tell you to visit her once in a while.
Just when I was beginning to forget, that bird of ill omen came flapping my way to rip open with its beak the wounds of memory. All at once, shame over the past and the recollection of sin unfolded themselves before my eyes and, seized by a terror so great it made me want to shriek, I could not sit still a moment longer.
How about a drink? I asked. Suits me, said Hariki.
Hariki and myself. Though outwardly, he appeared to be a human being like the rest, I sometimes felt he was exactly like myself. Of course, that was only after we had been making the round of the bars, drinking cheap liquor here and there. When the two of us met face to face, it was as if we immediately metamorphosed into dogs of the same shape and pelt, and we bounded out through the streets covered with fallen snow. That was how we happened to warm over, as it were, the embers of our old friendship. We went together to the bar in Kyobashi and, eventually, we two soused dogs visited Shizuko's apartment in Koenji, where I sometimes spent the night. I shall never forget. It was a sticky, hot summer's night. Hariki had come to my apartment about dusk, wearing a tattered summer kimono. He told me that an emergency had come up, and he had been obliged to pawn his summer suit. He asked me to lend him some money, because he was anxious to redeem the suit before his aged mother found out. The matter apparently concerned him genuinely. As ill luck would have it, I hadn't any money at my place. As usual, I sent Yoshiko out to the pawn shop with some of her clothes. I lent Hariki what he needed from the money she received, but there was still a little left over, and I asked Yoshiko to buy some gin with it. We went up to the roof of the apartment house, where we celebrated the evening cool with a dismal little party. Faint miasmic gusts of wind blew in from the river every now and then. We began a guessing game of tragic and comic nouns. This game, which I myself had invented, was based on the proposition that just as nouns could be divided into masculine, feminine, and neuter, so there was a distinction between tragic and comic nouns. For example, the system decreed that steamship and steam engine were both tragic nouns, while streetcar and bus were comic. Persons who failed to see why this was true were obviously unqualified to discuss art, and a playwright who included even a single tragic noun in a comedy showed himself a failure, if for no other reason. The same held equally true of comic nouns in tragedies. I began the questioning.
Are you ready? What is tobacco?
Tragic, Hariki answered promptly.
What about medicine? Powder or pills?
Injection.
Tragic. I wonder. Don't forget, there are hormone injections too. No, there's no question, but it's tragic. First of all, there's a needle. What could be more tragic than a needle? You win.
But you know, medicines and doctors are surprisingly enough comic. What about death?
Comic. And that goes for Christian ministers and Buddhist priests, too.
Bravo.
Then life must be tragic?
Wrong. It's comic, too.
In that case, everything becomes comic. Here's one more for you. What about cartoonists? You couldn't possibly call it a comic noun, could you?
Tragic. An extremely tragic noun.
What do you mean? Extremely tragic is a good description of you.
Any game which can drop to the level of such abysmal jokes is despicable. But we were very proud of what we considered to be an extremely witty diversion, never before known in the salons of the world. I had invented one other game of a rather similar character, a guessing game of antonyms. The antonym of black is white, but the antonym of white is red. The antonym of red is black. I asked now, what is the antonym of flower?
Hariki frowned in thought.
Let me see. There used to be a restaurant called the Flower Moon. It must be moon.
That's not an antonym. It's more of a synonym. Aren't star and garter synonymous? It's not an antonym.
I've got it. It's
bee. Bee?
Aren't there bees, or is it ants in peonies?
What are you trying to do? No bluffing now.
I know. Clustering clouds that cover the flowers.
You must be thinking of clouds that cover the moon.
That's right. Wind that destroys the blossoms. It's the wind. The antonym of flower is wind.
Pretty poor. Sounds like a line out of a popular song. You betray your origins.
Well then, how about something more recondite? Say a mandolin.
Still no good. The antonym of flower... You're supposed to name the thing in the world which is least like a flower.
That's what I'm trying to do. Wait, how about this? A woman?
Then what's a synonym for woman?
Entrails.
You're not very poetic, are you?
Well then, what's the antonym for entrails?
Milk.
That's pretty good.
One more in that vein.
Shame.
What's the antonym of shame?
Shameless. A popular cartoonist I could name.
What about Masao Horiki? By the time we reached this point, we had gradually become incapable of laughter, and were beginning to experience the particular oppressiveness, as if one's head were stuffed with broken glass, that comes from getting drunk on gin.
Don't be cheeky now. I, for one, have never been tied up like a common criminal the way you have.
I was taken aback. Hariki, at heart, did not treat me like a full human being. He could only consider me as the living corpse of a would-be suicide, a person dead to shame, an idiot ghost. His friendship had no other purpose but to utilize me in whichever way would most further his own pleasures. This thought naturally did not make me very happy, but I realized after a moment that it was entirely to be expected that Hariki should take this view of me, that from long ago, even as a child, I seemed to lack the qualifications of a human being, and that for all I knew, contempt, even from Hariki, might be entirely merited. I said, feigning tranquility, "Crime. What's the antonym of crime? This is a hard one."
"The law, of course,"
Hariki answered flatly. I looked at his face again, caught in the flashing red light of a neon sign on a nearby building. Hariki's face had the somber dignity of the relentless prosecutor. I felt shaken to the core. "Crime belongs in a different category." Imagine saying that the law was the antonym of crime.
but perhaps everybody in society can go on living in self-satisfaction thanks to just such simple concepts. They think that crime hatches where there are no policemen.
Well, in that case, what would it be? God? That would suit you. There's something about you that smells a little of a Christian priest. I find it offensive.
Let's not dispose of the problem so lightly. Let's think about it a bit more together.
Isn't it an interesting theme? I feel you can tell everything about a man just from his answer to this one question. You can't be serious. The antonym of crime is virtue. A virtuous citizen. In short, someone like myself.
Let's not joke. Virtue is the antonym of vice, not of crime.
Are vice and crime different?
They are, I think. Virtue and vice are concepts invented by human beings. Words for morality which human beings arbitrarily devised.
What a nuisance. Well, I suppose it is God in that case. God. God. You can't go wrong if you leave everything at God.
I'm hungry. Yoshiko is cooking some beans downstairs now.
Thanks. I like beans.
He lay down on the floor, his hands tucked under his head.
I said, "You don't seem to be very interested in crime."
That's right. I'm not a criminal like you. I may indulge myself with a little dissipation, but I don't cause women to die, and I don't lift money from them either.
The voice of a resistance, weak but desperate, spoke from somewhere in my heart. It said that I had not caused anyone to die, that I had not lifted money from anyone. But once again, the ingrained habit of considering myself evil took command. It is quite impossible for me to contradict anyone to his face. I struggled with all my might to control the feelings which mounted more dangerously in me with each instant, the result of the depressing effects of the gin. Finally, I muttered almost to myself, "Actions punishable by jail sentences are not the only crimes. If we knew the antonym of crime, I think we would know its true nature. God, salvation, love, light. But for God, there is the antonym Satan. For salvation, there is perdition. For love, there is hate. For light, there is darkness. For good, evil. Crime and prayer? Crime and repentance? Crime and confession? Crime and...
No, they're all synonymous.
What is the opposite of crime?
Well, if you spell crime backwards... No, that doesn't make sense. But the word does contain the letters R-I-C-E. Rice. I'm hungry. Bring me something to eat.
Why don't you go get it yourself?
My voice shook with a rage I had almost never before betrayed.
All right. I'll go downstairs. Then Yoshiko and I will commit a crime together. Personal demonstration is better than empty debates. The antonym of crime is rice. No. It's beans.
He was so drunk he could barely articulate the words. Do as you please. Only get the hell out of here.
He got up mumbling incoherently.
Crime and an empty stomach. Empty stomach and beans. No, those are synonyms.
Crime and punishment. Dostoevsky. These words grazed over a corner of my mind, startling me. Just supposing Dostoevsky ranged crime and punishment side by side, not as synonyms, but as antonyms. Crime and punishment. Absolutely incompatible ideas, irreconcilable as oil and water. I felt I was beginning to understand what lay at the bottom of the scum-covered, turbid pond, that chaos of Dostoevsky's mind. No, I still didn't quite see. Such thoughts were flashing through my head like a revolving lantern when I heard a voice.
"Extraordinary beings you've got here. Come have a look."
Hariki's voice and color had changed. Just a minute before he had staggered off downstairs, and here he was back again before I knew it. "What is it?" A strange excitement ran through me. The two of us went down from the roof to the second floor and were halfway down the stairs to my room on the ground floor when Hariki stopped me and whispered,
"Look."
He pointed. A small window opened over my room, through which I could see the interior. The light was lit, and two animals were visible. My eyes swam, but I murmured to myself through my violent breathing, "This is just another aspect of the behavior of human beings. There's nothing to be surprised at." I stood petrified on the staircase, not even thinking to help Yoshiko. Hariki noisily cleared his throat. I ran back up to the roof to escape and collapsed there. The feelings which assailed me, as I looked up at the summer night sky, heavy with rain, were not of fury or hatred, nor even of sadness. They were of overpowering fear. Not the terror the sight of ghosts in a graveyard might arouse, but rather a fierce ancestral dread that could not be expressed in 4 or 5 words. Something perhaps like encountering in the sacred grove of a Shinto shrine the white-clothed body of the god. My hair turned prematurely gray from that night. I had now lost all confidence in myself, doubted all men immeasurably, and abandoned all hopes for the things of this world, all joy, all sympathy, eternally. This was truly the decisive incident of my life. I had been split through the forehead between the eyebrows, a wound that was to throb with pain whenever I came in contact with a human being.
"I sympathize, but I hope it's taught you a lesson. I won't be coming back. This place is a perfect hell. But you should forgive Yoshiko. After all, you're not much of a prize yourself. So long."
Hariki was not stupid enough to linger in an embarrassing situation. I got up and poured myself a glass of gin. I wept bitterly, crying aloud. I could have wept on and on, interminably. Without my realizing it, Yoshiko was standing haplessly behind me, bearing a platter with a mountain of beans on it.
"He told me he wouldn't do anything."
"It's all right. Don't say anything. You didn't know enough to distrust others. Sit down. Let's eat the beans." We sat down side by side and ate the beans. Is trustfulness a sin, I wonder? The man was an illiterate shopkeeper, an undersized runt of about 30, who used to ask me to draw cartoons for him, and then would make a great ado over the trifling sums of money he paid for them. The shopkeeper, not surprisingly, did not come again. I felt less hatred for him than I did for Hariki. Why, when he first discovered them together, had he not cleared his throat then, instead of returning to the roof to inform me? On nights when I could not sleep, hatred and loathing for him gathered inside me until I groaned under the pressure. I neither forgave nor refused to forgive her. Yoshiko was a genius at trusting people. She didn't know how to suspect anyone. But the misery it caused. God, I ask you, is trustfulness a sin? It was less the fact of Yoshiko's defilement than the defilement of her trust in people which became so persistent a source of grief as almost to render my life insupportable. For someone like myself, in whom the ability to trust others is so cracked and broken that I am wretchedly timid and am forever trying to read the expression on people's faces. Yoshiko's immaculate trustfulness seemed clean and pure, like a waterfall among green leaves. One night sufficed to turn the waters of this pure cascade yellow and muddy. Yoshiko began from that night to fret over my every smile or frown. She would jump when I called her, and seemed at a loss which way to turn. She remained tense and afraid, no matter how much I tried to make her smile, no matter how much I played the clown. She began to address me with an excessive profusion of honorifics. Is immaculate trustfulness, after all, a source of sin? I looked up various novels in which married women are violated. I tried reading them, but I could not find a single instance of a woman violated in so lamentable a manner as Yoshiko. Her story, obviously, could never be made into a novel. I might actually have felt better if anything in the least resembling love existed between that runt of a shopkeeper and Yoshiko. But one summer night, Yoshiko was trusting, and that was all there was to it. And on account of that incident, I was cleft between the eyebrows. My voice became hoarse. My hair turned prematurely gray. And Yoshiko was condemned to a life of anxiety. In most of the novels I read, emphasis was placed on whether or not the husband forgave the wife's act. It seemed to me, however, that any husband who still retains the right to forgive or to not forgive is a lucky man. If he thinks that he can't possibly forgive his wife, he ought, instead of making such a great fuss, to get divorced as quickly as possible and find a new wife. If he can't do that, he should forgive and show forbearance. In either case, the matter can be completely settled in whichever way the husband's feelings dictate. In other words, even though such an incident certainly comes as a great shock to the husband, it is a shock and not an endless series of waves which lash back at him over and over again. It seemed to me a problem which could be disposed of by the wrath of any husband with authority. But in our case, the husband was without authority. And when I thought things over, I came to feel that everything was my fault. Far from becoming enraged, I could not utter a word of complaint. It was on account of that rare virtue she possessed that my wife was violated, a virtue I had long prized, the unbearably pitiful one called immaculate trustfulness. Is immaculate trustfulness a sin? Now that I harbored doubts about the one virtue I had depended on, I lost all comprehension of everything around me. My only resort was drink. My face coarsened markedly, and my teeth fell out from the interminable drinking bouts to which I surrendered myself. The cartoons I drew now verged on the pornographic. No, I'll come out with it plainly. I began about this time to copy pornographic pictures which I secretly peddled. I wanted money to buy gin. When I looked at Yoshiko, always averting her glance and trembling, doubt gave birth to fresh doubt. It was unlikely, wasn't it, that a woman with absolutely no defenses should have yielded only that once with the shopkeeper? Had she also been with Horiki, or with somebody I didn't even know? I hadn't the courage to question her. Writhing in my usual doubts and fears, I drank gin. Sometimes when drunk, I timidly attempted a few sneaking ventures at indirect questioning. In my heart, I bounded foolishly from joy to sorrow at her responses. But on the surface, I never ceased my immoderate clowning. Afterwards, I would inflict on Yoshiko an abominable, hellish caressing before I dropped into a dead sleep. Towards the end of that year, I came home late one night, blind drunk. I felt like having a glass of sugar water. Yoshiko seemed to be asleep, so I went myself to the kitchen to look for the sugar bowl. I took off the lid and peered inside. There was no sugar, only a thin black cardboard box. I took it absentmindedly in my hand and read the label. I was startled. Somebody had scratched off most of the writing, but the part in Western letters remained intact. The word dial was legible. Dial. At the time, I relied entirely on gin and never took sleeping pills. Insomnia, however, was a chronic complaint with me, and I was familiar with most sleeping pills. The contents of this one box of dial was unquestionably more than sufficient to cause death. The seal of the box was unbroken. I must have hidden it here at some time or other in the past when I felt I might need it, after first scratching off the label. The poor child could not read Western letters, and I must have thought it was enough if I just scratched off with my nails the part of the label in Japanese. You have committed no sin. I very quietly filled a glass with water, careful not to make the least noise, and deliberately broke the seal of the box. I poured the whole contents into my mouth. I calmly drained the glass of water in one gulp. I switched off the light and went to bed at once. For 3 days and nights, I lay as one dead. The doctor considered it an accident and was kind enough to postpone reporting to the police. I am told that the first words I murmured as I began to recover consciousness were, "I'm going home." It's not clear even to myself what place I meant by home, but in any case, these were the words I said, accompanied, I was told, by profuse weeping. Gradually the fog cleared, and when I regained consciousness, there was Flatfish sitting at my pillow, a most unpleasant expression on his face.
"The last time was also at the end of the year, wasn't it? He always chooses the end of the year, just when everybody is frantically busy. He'll prove the death of me if he keeps on doing such things."
The madam of the bar in Kyobashi was the recipient of Flatfish's discourse. I called.
"Madam."
"What? Have you come too?"
She held her smiling face directly over mine as she spoke. I burst into tears. "Take me away from Yoshiko."
The words came as a surprise even to myself. The madam rose to her feet and breathed a barely audible sigh. Then I made an utterly unpremeditated slip of the tongue, one so comic, so idiotic, that it all but defies description. I said, "I'm going somewhere where there aren't any women." Flatfish was the first to respond, with loud guffaws. The madam tittered, and in the midst of my tears, I turned red and smiled despite myself.
"An excellent idea," said Flatfish,
still continuing his inane laughter.
"You really ought to go to a place with no women. Everything goes wrong as soon as women are around you." "Yes. A place without women is a fine suggestion."
A place without women. And the worst of it was that my delirious ravings were later to be realized in a most ghastly way. Yoshiko seemed to have got the idea that I had swallowed the overdose of sleeping pills by way of atonement for her sin, and this made her all the more uncertain before me. She never smiled, and she looked as if she could hardly be persuaded to open her mouth. I found the apartment so oppressive that I would end by going out as usual to swill cheap liquor. After the dial incident, however, I lost weight noticeably. My arms and legs felt heavy, and I often was too lazy to draw cartoons. Flatfish had left some money when he came to visit me. He said,
"It's a little gift from me,"
and offered it exactly as if it were his own money, though I gathered that it actually came from my brothers as usual. This time, unlike when I ran away from Flatfish's house, I was able to get a vague glimpse through his theatrical airs of importance. I too was clever and,
pretending to be completely unaware of what was going on, humbly offered Flatfish my thanks for the money. It nevertheless gave me a strange feeling, as if at the same time I could and could not understand why people like Flatfish resorted to such complicated tricks. I did not hesitate to use the money to go by myself to the hot springs of southern Izu. However, I am not the kind to make a leisurely tour of hot springs, and at the thought of Yoshiko, I became so infinitely forlorn as to destroy completely the peaceful frame of mind which would have permitted me to gaze from my hotel window at the mountains. I did not change into sports clothes. I didn't even take the waters. Instead, I would rush out into the filthy little bars that looked like souvenir stands and drink gin until I fairly swam in it. I returned to Tokyo, only sicklier for the trip. The night I returned to Tokyo, the snow was falling heavily. I drunkenly wandered along the rows of saloons behind the Ginza, singing to myself over and over again, so softly it was only a whisper. From here it's hundreds of miles to home. From here it's hundreds of miles to home. I walked along kicking with the point of my shoes the snow which was accumulating. Suddenly, I vomited. This was the first time I had brought up blood. It formed a big, rising sun flag in the snow. I squatted there for a while. Then, with both hands, I scooped up snow from places which were still clean and washed my face. I wept. Where does this little path go? Where does this little path go? I could hear indistinctly from the distance, like an auditory hallucination, the voice of a little girl singing. Unhappiness. There are all kinds of unhappy people in this world. I suppose it would be no exaggeration to say that the world is composed entirely of unhappy people. But those people can fight their unhappiness with society fairly and squarely, and society for its part easily understands and sympathizes with such struggles. My unhappiness stemmed entirely from my own vices, and I had no way of fighting anybody. If I had ever attempted to voice anything in the nature of a protest, even a single mumbled word, the whole of society, and not only Flatfish, would undoubtedly have cried out flabbergasted, "Imagine the audacity of him talking like that!" Am I what they call an egoist? Or am I the opposite, a man of excessively weak spirit? I really don't know myself, but since I seem in either case to be a mass of vices, I drop steadily, inevitably, into unhappiness, and I have no specific plan to stave off my descent. I got up from the snowbank with the thought, I ought to get the proper kind of medicine without delay. I went into a pharmacy nearby. The proprietress and I exchanged looks as I entered. For that instant, her eyes popped, and she held her head lifted, as if caught in the light of a flashbulb. She stood ramrod stiff, but in her wide-open eyes there was no trace of alarm or dislike. Her look spoke of longing, almost of the seeking for salvation. I thought, she must be unhappy too. Unhappy people are sensitive to the unhappiness of others. Not until then did I happen to notice that she stood with difficulty, supporting herself on crutches. I suppressed a desire to run up beside her, but I could not take my eyes from her face. I felt tears starting, and saw then the tears brimming from her big eyes. That was all. Without saying a word, I went out of the pharmacy and staggered back to my apartment. I asked Yoshiko to prepare a salt solution. I drank it. I went to sleep without telling her anything. The whole of the following day I spent in bed, giving as excuse a lie to the effect that I felt a cold coming on. At night, My agitation over the blood I had secretly coughed became too much for me, and I got out of bed. I went to the pharmacy again. This time, I confessed with a smile to the woman what my physical condition was. In humble tones, I asked her advice. "You'll have to give up drinking." We were like blood relatives. "I may have alcoholic poisoning. I still want to drink." "You mustn't. My husband used to soak himself in liquor in spite of his TB. He claimed that he killed the germs with liquor. That's how he shortened his life." I feel so on edge, I can't stand it. I'm afraid. I'm no good for anything. "I'll give you some medicine, but please cut out the drinking at least." She was a widow with an only son. The boy had been attending a medical school somewhere in the provinces, but was now on leave of absence from school with the same illness that killed his father. Her father-in-law lay abed in the house with palsy. She herself had been unable to move one side of her body since she was 5, when she had infantile paralysis. Hobbling here and there in the shop on her crutches, she selected various medicines from the different shelves and explained what they were. "This is a medicine to build your blood. This is a serum for vitamin injections. Here is the hypodermic needle. These are calcium pills. This is diastase to keep you from getting an upset stomach." Her voice was full of tenderness as she explained each of the half dozen medicines. The affection of this unhappy woman was, however, to prove too intense. At the last she said, "This is a medicine to be used when you need a drink so badly you can't stand it." She quickly wrapped the little box. It was morphine. She said that it was no more harmful than liquor, and I believed her. For one thing, I was just at the stage where I had come to feel the squalor of drunkenness, and I was overjoyed to be able to escape after such long bondage to the devil called alcohol. Without a flicker of hesitation, I injected the morphine into my arm. My insecurity, fretfulness, and timidity were swept away completely. I turned into an expansively optimistic and fluent talker. The injections made me forget how weak my body was, and I applied myself energetically to my cartoons. Sometimes I would burst out laughing even while I was drawing. I had intended to take one shot a day, but it became 2, then 3. When it reached 4, I could no longer work unless I had my shots. All I needed was the woman at the pharmacy to admonish me, saying how dreadful it would be if I became an addict, for me to feel that I had already become a fairly confirmed addict. I am very susceptible to other people's suggestions. When people say to me, "You really shouldn't spend this money, but I suppose you will anyway," I have the strange illusion that I would be going against expectations and somehow doing wrong unless I spent it. I invariably spend all the money immediately. My uneasiness over having become an addict actually made me seek more of the drug. "I beg you, one more box. I promise I'll pay you at the end of the month." "You can pay the bill any old time as far as I'm concerned, but the police are very troublesome, you know." Something impure, dark, reeking of the shady character, always hovers about me. "I beg you, tell them something or other. Put them off the track. I'll give you a kiss." She blushed. I pursued the theme. "I can't do any work unless I have the medicine. It's a kind of energy builder for me." "How about hormone injections?" "Don't be silly. It's liquor or that medicine, one or the other. If I haven't got it, I can't work." "You mustn't drink." "That's right. I haven't touched a drop of liquor since I began with that medicine. I'm in fine physical shape thanks to you. I don't intend to go on drawing stupid cartoons forever, you know. Now that I've stopped drinking and have straightened myself out, I'm going to study. I'm sure I can become a great painter. I'll show you. If only I can get over this critical period. So please, how about a kiss?
She burst out laughing.
What a nuisance you are. You may already have become an addict for all I know.
Her crutches clacked as she hobbled over to the shelf to take down some medicine.
I can't give you a whole box. You'd use it all up. Here's half. How stingy you've become. Well, if that's the best you can do.
I gave myself a shot as soon as I got back home.
Yoshiko timidly asked, Doesn't it hurt? Of course it hurts, but I've got to do it no matter how painful it is. That's the only way to increase the efficiency of my work. You've noticed how healthy I've been of late.
Then playfully, Well, to work, to work, to work. Once, late at night, I knocked on the door of the pharmacy. As soon as I caught sight of the woman in her nightgown hobbling forward on her crutches, I threw my arms around her and kissed her. I pretended to weep. She handed me a box without a word. By the time I had come to realize acutely that drugs were as abominable, as foul, no, fouler, than gin, I had already become an out-and-out addict. I had truly reached the extreme of shamelessness. Out of the desire to obtain the drug, I began again to make copies of pornographic pictures. I also had what might literally be called a very ugly affair with the crippled woman from the pharmacy. I thought, I want to die. I want to die more than ever before. There's no chance now of a recovery. No matter what sort of thing I do, no matter what I do, it's sure to be a failure. Just a final coating applied to my shame. That dream of going on bicycles to see a waterfall framed in summer leaves, it was not for the likes of me. All that can happen now is that one foul, humiliating sin will be piled on another, and my sufferings will become only the more acute. I want to die. I must die. Living itself is the source of sin. I paced back and forth, half in a frenzy, between my apartment and the pharmacy. The more I worked, the more morphine I consumed, and my debt at the pharmacy reached a frightening figure. Whenever the woman caught sight of my face, the tears came to her eyes. I also wept. Inferno. I decided as a last resort, my last hope of escaping the inferno, to write a long letter to my father in which I confessed my circumstances fully and accurately, with the exception, of course, of my relations with women. If it failed, I had no choice but to hang myself, a resolve which was tantamount to a bet on the existence of God. The result was to make everything only the worse. The answer, for which I waited day and night, never came, and my anxiety and dread caused me to increase still further the dosage of the drug. I made up my mind one day to give myself 10 shots that night and throw myself into the river. But on the afternoon of the very day I chose for the event, Flatfish appeared with Horiki in tow, seemingly having managed with his diabolical intuition to sniff out my plan. Horiki sat in front of me and said, with a gentle smile, the like of which I had never before seen on his face, I hear you've coughed blood. I felt so grateful, so happy for that gentle smile, that I averted my face and wept. I was completely shattered and smothered by that one gentle smile. I was bundled into an automobile. Flatfish informed me in a quiet tone, so calm indeed that it might almost have been characterized as compassionate, that I should have to go for the time being to a hospital, and I should leave everything to them. Weeping helplessly, I obeyed whatever the two of them decreed, like a man bereft of all will, decision, and everything else. The four of us, Yoshiko came along, were tossed in the car for quite a long time. About dusk,
we pulled up at the entrance to a large hospital in the woods. My only thought was, this must be a sanatorium. I was given a careful, almost unpleasantly considerate examination by